WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tibet has captured the imagination of Westerners for centuries. It's been seen as the unreachable city shrouded in mystery on the rooftop of the world, a sacred place where monks can transcend the trappings of the physical world and oracles can foresee the future. Since the 50s, much of Tibetan culture has been destroyed by the Chinese occupation. My guest Orville Schell has written a new book called Virtual Tibet, about the place of Tibet in the collective Western imagination and the fantasy versions that have been created in our pop culture. Schell is a China scholar. He's also the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. I asked him what the manifestations of Tibet were in American pop culture when he started his book.
When I started the book, Hollywood was just beginning to gear up to do a number of films on Tibet. There was 7 years in Tibet, the story of Heinrich Harrer's 7 years in Lhasa during the war. Martin Scorsese was gearing up to do the story of the Dalai Lama's early life in Kundun. There were many documentaries being made. Even Steven Seagal was planning an action pic. And I sort of picked up on this and I thought, oh, this is interesting. It looks like we're going to go through another sort of incarnation of the West's fascination with this mysterious and interesting place. And I thought, well, I'm interested in Tibet too, but maybe what I should try to cover is not Tibet itself, but this our version of Tibet, what I like to call virtual Tibet, and to try to look at it through these movies and through other aspects of its manifestation, if you will, in popular culture and politics.
Why? To see what we want from a place like Tibet? What did you want to do by looking at this virtual Tibet?
I was very fascinated in Tibet myself, and I had fallen under its spell as a young boy when I first read Heinrich Harrer's 7 Years in Tibet, which came out in the early 50s. And this, you know, this wonderful story of adventure about this Austrian mountain climber who'd been arrested by the Brits during the war, escaped from prison camp in India, climbed over the Himalayas, and spent 2 years making his way through tremendously arduous circumstances to Lhasa, where he became the tutor of the Dalai Lama. And this created for me, too, a sort of a childhood vision of this marvelously detached other place that was tucked behind the Himalayas. So I had been inoculated in an early age, like many people, with the idea of Tibet. So, and of course, I've had a longtime interest in China, and I think it's fair to say that what China has done to Tibet, its occupation, is one of the great tragedies of this century. So there was sort of a double payoff for me. There was one, the fantasy of this place, and two, then there was the tragedy of Tibet and this incredibly intractable issue, which seems to brook all efforts to resolve it, that between China and Tibet, and indeed Tibet's place in the whole panoply of problems that China runs into in trying to become a respectable power integrated into the world community.
Why don't you place us briefly, when did China invade Tibet?
Well, in 1949, when the communists took over the mainland, Mao Zedong had Deng Xiaoping, who was in a military command adjacent to Tibet, start to occupy the eastern regions and ultimately march all the way to Lhasa. And it must be said that after that, almost every monastery in Tibet was destroyed. But indeed, the same thing happened in China. There was this very violent militant reaction against traditional culture, and it extended to Tibet, which of course was the paradigm of traditional culture. And then in 1959, after an interregnum where there was a certain amount of cooperation between China and the government of the Dalai Lama, things heated up again. There was a rebellion, and the Dalai Lama fled to India, where he has lived in exile in Dharamsala ever since.
Tibet has become an important place for Hollywood, not just because of movies that Hollywood has made about Tibet, but also because a lot of Hollywood stars have become very interested in Tibetan Buddhism and the Dalai Lama, particularly, of course, Richard Gere, who's been a Buddhist for about 25 years. And I think the Dalai Lama has even been to Hollywood functions. Why do you think that the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhism is making such an impact on celebrities now?
Well, I think each gets something out of it. You know, the celebrities are really questing for some sort of spiritual meaning. In a certain sense, I mean, celebrities are on the in the very center of this vortex of, you know, of commerce and money and business and deal making. And I think many of their lives lack a certain sort of spiritual quotient. On the Dalai Lama, on the other hand, I mean, he's looking for salvation for his people. And one can hardly fault him for, you know, taking every opportunity to write a little larger the story of what's happened to Tibet and Tibetans. And so he is you know, finds it compelling to go to Hollywood to have these rich and powerful people who have access to the media speak on his behalf and buddy up with him. But there is a kind of a paradox involved because historically speaking, one of the reasons we've always loved the Dalai Lama and been so fascinated with him, this sort of God-king notion, is that he has been aloof. He has been unapproachable. He has been tucked away in Lhasa, and we couldn't get access to him. And if there's anything that drives people to frantic levels of enthrallment in Hollywood, it's, you know, not being able to get access to someone. Well, so here he is in Hollywood going to fundraisers, which, as I say, one can hardly fault him for doing. But at the same time, that sort of ineffable spiritual aloof quality that has made him so interesting to people is in some sense diminished. So he's kind of walking a really tricky tightrope between too much availability and no availability, which is certainly bad for his cause because his only avenue of appeal, he has no country, he has no ambassadors, he isn't in the UN. So the only thing he can do is to be one man making pleas to get exposure through the media.
The West has idealized Tibet as a Shangri-La, as a utopian spiritual society. On the opposite side, we have China, which has not only, you know, invaded Tibet and destroyed most of the temples there and imprisoned many of the Buddhists there, but China has also described Tibet as a feudal system where the Dalai Lama ruled over exploited serfs. Is there any truth at all to the Chinese point of view of Tibet having been a feudal system?
Yes. I mean, I think one would have to say that the old system, even though people adored the Lord Buddha and were held in a kind of a society was stable. There are not a lot of examples of rebellion, and it did function in a way. But yes, the estates that were the fundamental kind of building block of Tibetan society were controlled both by the monasteries and by the aristocrats, and ordinary Tibetans were in a serf-like status working on these estates. And that's why when China looked up there, and having been through the process of land reform itself, of liberating peasants and taking land from the landlords and giving it to the peasants, they thought, well, here's another good opportunity for us to bring Marxist, Leninist, Maoist liberation theology to an even more benighted place. And I mean, this is part of the Western vision has a hard time incorporating the old society, the brutal aspects of the old society in its new sort of veneration of what Tibet was. And we look back very nostalgically at the way it was and like to overlook the fact that it did have some tremendously unequal, exploitative, and indeed unjust aspects to it.
My guest is Orville Schell, and he's written extensively about China. His new book is called Virtual Tibet, Searching for Shangri-La from the Himalayas to Hollywood. The geography of Tibet, as you point out, contributed to making Tibet so mysterious and isolated. Because it's surrounded by mountains, it's very hard to get to. At the same time, Tibet wanted to remain isolated. Why did it want to remain isolated for so long?
Well, it was a combination of Tibet not really knowing what was in the outside world and feeling quite sufficient unto itself. Tibetans were pretty content just to stay home, but it so happened that Tibet itself became the object of the sort of exploratory curiosity of the West. And this is a very sort of different cultural aspect that is a hallmark of Tibetan society and culture, and I think a part that makes us rather intrigued, because we are so inquisitive, we are so Promethean, we are so eager to conquer, to explore, to reach out. And the West had colonies, the West had explorers, the West had wars, and Tibet was just sitting there quietly alone at home, minding its own business. And it was, it did intrigue us. It was the antithesis of everything that we felt. And, you know, particularly in the 30s, as Europe and the West headed towards apocalypse and war, Frank Capra's movie Lost Horizon came out and enshrined forever the notion of Shangri-La in popular culture, one of the most powerful utopian mythologies, I think, that we've had during this century. And it basically bespoke of a place where people didn't get old, they didn't get sick, where everything was peaceful and civilized. And it was an intoxicating dream for the West heading into the nightmare of World War II.
In 1904, there was a British mission that was sent to Tibet to try to prevent Tibet from opening relations with Russia. And the force was sent off by the British viceroy in India. It was led by Colonel Francis Younghusband, who set off from India to Lhasa with, you say, about 1,000 British and Indian troops. They had guns. The Tibetans didn't. What were the results of this in Tibet?
Well, the Younghusband expedition was a very sorry episode in British imperial history. The British were fearful that Tibet, Lhasa, would unite with the Tsarist government in Russia. And so they sent this expedition. They battled their way through Tibet, killing thousands of Tibetans, and they reached Lhasa and forced the Tibetans to sign an accord. And what was really strange about this trip was that as the soldiers are on their way up, they're writing all of these diaries about Tibet and the enormous sense of expectation at last being the first people in 100 years to reach Lhasa is overpowering. They're so excited at the prospect of getting to the heart of this mysterium. And in fact, when they get there, they see the Potala, the winter palace of the Dalai Lama on Red Hill, and they were extraordinarily excited. But when they get into Lhasa itself, they find it rather grubby and run down and a lot of mangy dogs running in the street. And they find that the Tibetan theocracy is not quite as exalted in terms of spiritual calories as they'd imagined, that it's, quite bureaucratic and sometimes quite oppressive. And they leave off quite dispirited. But the fact was that they did leave lots of accounts, and it didn't dim the West's passion for Tibet and the West's eagerness to imbue it with mythic kinds of proportions. And then, of course, the mountain climbers came into the scene.
The mountain climbers came looking for adventure?
Well, Europe used to loathe mountains. But around the 18th, 19th century, suddenly as landscape painting became interesting to people and naturalism began to become more intriguing, you began to get a new appreciation of mountains, not just as formidable and ugly and cold, but as beautiful and pure and almost religious in significance. But alas, the British had no mountains. Their mountains were, such as they were north of India in the Himalayas. So they began to imbue the Himalayas with a whole mysticism of its own. And mountain climbers then began to seek to conquer some of these Himalayan peaks. And you get lots of very, very purple, some of it very good writing, actually, about the majesty of the Himalayas and the beauty and of the mountains, their purity. And this, too, imbued Tibet with a more kind of sacred quality than ever before. So this was a new element that got added to to some of the old ideas of Tibet as being just a spiritually dense and important place. Suddenly, it became a natural landscape that was very interesting to Europeans, and that added a whole new dimension, which continues on today with our fascination with Mount Everest and our fascination with heights as being, you know, close to heaven, close to God.
My guest is Orville Schell, author of Virtual Tibet. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Orville Schell, author of Virtual Tibet. Now, the book that got you interested in Tibet was 7 Years in Tibet by Heinrich Harrer, the book that was made into a film a few years ago starring Brad Pitt. You actually went to the set of the Brad Pitt movie. What was it about the book that you loved?
Well, I think what I liked about the book was that it's a great adventure story for a young boy. You know, Heinrich Harrer, his 2 years eluding bandits and eluding the militia of the Tibetan government, and then reaching this forbidden city at last and being taken in by this mysterious god king and becoming his friend. He was only a teenager then, the Dalai Lama, and Auschneider and Harrer, who Auschneider was Harrer's partner, were just young men. So that did kind of, I think, plant the seed of a place that had great magic and mystery for me. And so when I heard that 7 Years in Tibet was being made, I thought, well, let's have a look. And indeed, I was able to go down to Argentina, where they rebuilt Lhasa in the Andes. They couldn't get to Tibet, and the Indian government was so frightened of China's reaction, because this subject of Tibet is so sensitive, that they wouldn't let them shoot in Ladakh, where there are many Tibetan Buddhist monasteries. So there, down in the Andes, Lhasa sprang forth full-blown, like, you know, Athena out of the head of Zeus, and they flew in 150 Tibetans, including many elderly monks from around the world. And when they arrived on the set of the Jokhang, the most sacred spiritual, it's a monastery, sort of a cathedral. It's hard to describe exactly what it is in Western terms. But when they arrived at that set, they felt as if they had arrived back home. And many of them hadn't been to Tibet since 1959 when they fled. And they literally fell down, prostrated themselves before this set, some weeping and others feeling tremendously emotional at this kind of very curious homecoming. And then ultimately they had a ceremony to bless the set.
You make a lovely comparison in the book to Brad Pitt and Tibet, in the sense of how Brad Pitt has been kind of romanticized, and all the fantasies that his fans project onto him being so similar to how people have fantasized so much about Tibet. I mean, one's just like a person, an actor, and the other is Tibet. But still,
well,
like
you
that
know,
comparison.
When I was down in Argentina, you know, it sounds a little corny to say, but there really was a feeling that if that set, that virtual set of Lhasa, had a god king, it was Brad Pitt. I mean, he was not always around. He was sort of aloof. He was hidden. I was told I couldn't see him. I couldn't speak to him. The PR people said that if, in fact, I ran into him on the set, I was in no circumstances to make a lunge at him and try to make contact. So for me, there did build up a kind of a counter mythology of this Hollywood god king on his virtual Tibetan set. And I did see him down there, but I didn't approach him, and ultimately was able to interview him. And, I mean, I felt a little bit like Sir Francis' young husband entering Lhasa. I mean, it was a bit of a disappointment to finally meet this incarnation of the real Brad Pitt, and to ask his views on Tibet and his film. And, you know, they weren't that interesting. And so there was a kind of a mythology there that was punctured. And it kind of highlighted for me the ways in which we do build up mythologies around people and places that are not accessible. And we can make of them what we will, and we do.
One thing I really admired about Brad Pitt when you interviewed him is that although his answers weren't necessarily, you know, very interesting or revealing, he did make a point of saying, I'm not a historian, I'm not a politician. You know, there's a limit to what I know or can tell you about Tibet. There's a limit to my opinions on Tibet. I was glad at least that he wasn't pretending to know a lot more than he did and pretending to have wisdom that he didn't have.
Yeah, he was a nice person, and he said, you know, listen, I'm just a guy who puts on makeup. I mean, he wasn't trying to be very oracular. And anyway, the film people had said it wouldn't do to say too much because China at that point had been making big trouble against both production companies by saying that they might be cut off and excommunicated from the land of the living in China, because suddenly China realized that these films were like a real offensive. Hollywood was sort of entering into the whole arena of foreign policy, and these films were going to have a fairly substantial effect on how the outside world saw Tibet and saw China. So the film companies didn't want a whole lot of politics heaped into the PR tours and the junkets that actors and actresses were being asked to undertake by the company. So they were trying to stay away from politics. Huh. But it was, yes, Brad Pitt, when I finally met him, was an ordinary mortal, not a god king.
Orville Schell is the author of Virtual Tibet. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Orville Schell, author of Virtual Tibet, Searching for Shangri-La from the Himalayas to Hollywood. It's about the place of Tibet in the West's collective imagination. Schell is the author of several books about China, has written for The New Yorker and The Atlantic, and is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. Now, while you were writing your book, Virtual Tibet, there was a new development that was revealed about the author of 7 Years in Tibet, Heinrich Harrer. And there was an Austrian journalist who revealed that Harrer had been a Nazi. He'd been a member of the Stormtroopers. What impact did that have on you as a great fan of his book, 7 Years in Tibet?
Well, when I actually went to Austria to meet Harrer before these revelations of his Nazi affiliations came out, and, you know, I found him, I mean, it almost seemed to me that he had been interviewed so many times that he was not only an automatic pilot, but he was sort of quoting his own book rather than his own experience. It was a weird experience, and I felt as if I didn't really kind of get to the heart of the matter. Subsequently, when it was revealed that he had this Nazi past, one began to understand a little why he wasn't more reflective and introspective about the whole experience. He wrote a very wonderful adventure book, but he didn't really delve into his own sort of inner workings or his inner fascination with Tibet or why he had left Austria or didn't go back. And, you know, it was a bit of it sort of besmirched the whole dream of him as the arch explorer, you know, sort of an esteemable quality, because behind in his past lurked this kind of dreadful Nazi past that had been not acknowledged.
You've met with the Dalai Lama. Many people who have met with him talk about the impact it's had on them being in the presence of this enlightened spiritual leader. Did you feel a special presence that he had?
I think, you know, the Dalai Lama is really a wonderful person in many ways. I do have great veneration for him. And I think the reason why one feels all the more this power is that he constantly eschews the role of God King. He's constantly sort of almost self-denigrating himself and trying to reduce himself to normal kind of mortal status. It's a very ingratiating quality, and people have often remarked upon the fact that the thing that makes him such a compelling person is that he seems to want nothing but your happiness, and one can't say that so readily about many other people. And, you know, the irony is that if one had to have an adversary, such as China does, I mean, one could only dream of having an adversary like the Dalai Lama, who is so reasonable and so sort of gracious, and I think always willing to try to see what it is that the other side is concerned about and to how to reconcile. He's a great reconciler. And the tragedy is that China can't join somehow with this very compelling, very reasonable and practical man. And that makes the tragedy of Tibet all the greater, because here is a good leader with no country, whereas most countries have, a country but no leader. There's an opportunity here, and the fact that China cannot take it is a kind of amazing, it's a source of huge frustration, I think, for the world at large, for the Tibetans, and it's a great shame, because when he passes, and he's now 64, the moment may pass when this extremely contentious and sensitive issue could be joined in a way that might have a happy ending.
You know, your book is about what the West has imagined Tibet to be and all the things that the West has projected onto Tibet, such as it's a Shangri-La, it's a utopia. China, which has, occupied Tibet since the 50s, has destroyed so much of what was special and wonderful about Tibet. But at the same time, I think by destroying it, it has made it even more important to have these fantasies about Tibet, because the real Tibet doesn't exist anymore. And in that sense, there can't be an expedition that goes to Tibet and is disappointed, because we all know it's been destroyed by China. So the Tibet that we revive in memory, there's no reality to contradict it anymore. There's only history and memory.
Well, that's why Hollywood is so important in all of this. You see, because in fact, the Tibet that we cared about, that we were fascinated with when Heinrich Harrer went there, was a Tibet that stopped in the 1950s when China began to occupy it. And yet, it's a kind of a testament to the powerful yearning that we have to believe in this old place, that we go on believing in it, even though it isn't there anymore. And we believe in it so deeply that, having been denied it, we have to seek refuge in Hollywood movies, which will recreate it in Argentina, or, as in Martin Scorsese's case, in Morocco. And I think it does bespeak of, a need for us as human beings to believe that there is some place that has some real basis in the world that is somehow, it makes sense, some place where we can project our hopes and yearnings for a society that works, that's humane, that's spiritual, that's not subject to all the ambiguities of life as we know it. And this is a dream that we very reluctantly will let go of. And that's why I think these Hollywood movies were so important.
Where do you see your role in all of this? Do you see yourself as the realist, the person who's trying to perceive what Tibet really was?
Well, you might well ask, why did I bother to write this? Many people will feel a little bit unhappy that I look at the mythology, and in a certain sense, I suppose, could say I do puncture it a bit. I guess I wrote it because it is such a powerful myth, and I think in some way that's very hard to describe, that when myths enter real negotiations and real foreign policy conflicts, it makes it very difficult to solve these conflicts. For instance, the Chinese just get apoplectic when they are confronted with this sort of dewy-eyed, view of Tibet, which they view as a kind of a hellhole, which they've gone in and cleaned up. And they get very angry, and they feel very beset upon, and it makes it very difficult for them to be in any posture where they could make concessions or where they could, imagine solving this problem in any way that would make sense to us. So in a certain way, I guess one could say that I can't think of many places that are more fraught with this sort of imagined fantasy life, and yet where the stakes are higher in terms of a real international problem with real people and real suffering and a terrible history of brutalization. And where will it all end? I don't know. But I suspect that it can't easily be solved unless we do get down to a kind of a reality about it.
Has Tibet had any impact on your spiritual life, if that's not too personal a question to ask?
Well, you know, being spending 4 or 5 years on this book and being around a lot of Tibetan Buddhists and American Buddhists, I must say that I find, you know, Buddhism a very compelling set of beliefs. There have been relatively few wars waged by Buddhists. There have been a few, but relatively few. It is a very persuasive and kind of a gentle sort of a religion that I've sat through many teachings by the Dalai Lama, and I do feel a close kindred spirit in many ways, and I think it has influenced me in many ways. Just how, I'm not quite sure, but it isn't a supernatural religion. It's more a kind of a prescription of how to be and how to treat your fellow beings with compassion and with respect. It's pretty simple in that respect. And one would have to say that the Dalai Lama is a pretty good representation, I think, of what it is he preaches.
Orville Schell, he's the author of Virtual Tibet, Searching for Shangri-La from the Himalayas to Hollywood. He's also the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley. Coming up, the editor of Kosovo's leading Albanian newspaper. He just received a democracy award. This is Fresh Air.